Bob Dylan, born Robert Allen Zimmerman, May 24, 1941, is an American singer-songwriter, poet, and painter. He has been a major figure in American music for five decades. Much of his most celebrated work dates from the 1960s, when he was an informal chronicler and an apparently reluctant figurehead of social unrest. Though he is well known for revolutionizing perception of the limits of popular music, in 1965 with a single, Like a Rolling Stone, a number of his earlier songs, such as Blowin' in the Wind and The Times They Are A-Changin', became anthems for the U.S. civil rights and anti-war movements. His early lyrics incorporated a variety of political, social, and philosophical, as well as literary influences. They defied existing pop music conventions and appealed hugely to the then-burgeoning counterculture. Initially inspired by the songs of Woody Guthrie, Robert Johnson, Hank Williams, and the performance styles of Buddy Holly and Little Richard, Dylan has both amplified and personalized musical genres, exploring numerous distinct traditions in American song, from folk, blues, and country to gospel, rock and roll, and rockabilly to English, Scottish, and Irish folk music, embracing even jazz and swing. Dylan performs with guitar, keyboards, and harmonica. Backed by a changing lineup of musicians, he has toured steadily since the late 1980s on what has been dubbed the never-ending tour. His accomplishments as a recording artist and performer have been central to his career, but his greatest contribution is generally considered to be his songwriting. Since 1994, Dylan has published three books of drawings and paintings, and his work has been exhibited in major art galleries. As songwriter-musician, Dylan has received numerous awards over the years, including Grammy, Golden Globe, and Academy Awards. He has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, Songwriters Hall of Fame. In 2008, Bob Dylan Pathway was opened in the singer's honor in his birthplace of Duluth, Minnesota. The Pulitzer Prize jury in 2008 awarded him a special citation for his profound impact on popular music and American culture, marked by lyrical compositions of extraordinary poetic power. Life and career, origins and musical beginnings. Robert Allen Zimmerman, Hebrew name Shabtai Zisei ben Avram, was born in St. Mary's Hospital on May 24, 1941 in Duluth, Minnesota, and raised in Hibbing, Minnesota, on the Mesabi Iron Range west of Lake Superior. His paternal grandparents, Zygmunt and Anna Zimmerman, emigrated from Odessa in the Russian Empire, now Ukraine, to the United States following the anti-Semitic pogroms of 1905. His maternal grandparents, Benjamin and Libya Edelstein, were Lithuanian Jews who arrived in the United States in 1902. In his autobiography, Chronicles, Volume 1, Dylan writes that his paternal grandparents' maiden name was Kyrgyz, and her family originated from Istanbul, Turkey. Dylan's parents, Abram Zimmerman and Beatrice Betty Stone, were part of the area's small but close-knit Jewish community. Robert Zimmerman lived in Duluth until age six, when his father was stricken with polio, and the family returned to his mother's hometown, Hibbing, where Zimmerman spent the rest of his childhood. Robert Zimmerman spent much of his youth listening to the radio, first to blues and country stations broadcasting from Shreveport, Louisiana, and later to early rock and roll. He formed several bands while he attended Hibbing High School. The Shadow Blasters was short-lived, but his next, the Golden Chords, lasted longer and played covers of popular songs. Their performance of Danny and the Juniors' Rock and Roll is Here to Stay at their high school talent show was so loud that the principal cut the microphone off. In his 1959 school yearbook, Robert Zimmerman listed his ambition to follow Little Richard. Same year, using the name Elston Gunn, he performed two dates with Bobby V, playing piano and providing hand claps. Zimmerman moved to Minneapolis in September 1959 and enrolled at the University of Minnesota, where his early focus on rock and roll gave way to an interest in American folk music. In 1985, Dylan explained the attraction that folk music had exerted on him. "The thing about rock and roll is that for me, it wasn't enough. There were great catchphrases and driving pulse rhythms, but the songs weren't serious or didn't reflect life in a realistic way. I knew that when I got into folk music, it was a more of a serious type thing. The songs were filled with more despair, more sadness, more triumph, more faith in the supernatural, much deeper feelings. He soon began to perform at the 10 o'clock Scholar, a coffee house a few blocks from campus, and became actively involved in the local dinky town folk music circuit. During his dinky town days, Zimmerman began introducing himself as Bob Dylan. In his autobiography, Dylan acknowledges that he had been influenced by the poetry of Dylan Thomas. Explaining his change of name in a 2004 interview, Dylan remarked, "You're born, you know, the wrong names, wrong parents. I mean, that happens. You call yourself what you want to call yourself. This is the land of the free." 1960s, relocation to New York and record deal. Dylan dropped out of college at the end of his freshman year. In January 1961, he traveled to New York City, hoping to perform there and visit his musical idol, Woody Guthrie, who was seriously ill with Huntington's disease in Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital. Guthrie had been a revelation to Dylan and was the biggest influence on his early performances. Describing Guthrie's impact on him, Dylan later wrote, "The songs themselves had the infinite sweep of humanity in them. It was the true voice of the American spirit. I said to myself I was going to be Guthrie's greatest disciple." As well as visiting Guthrie in the hospital, Dylan befriended Guthrie's acolyte, Ramblin' Jack Elliott. Much of Guthrie's repertoire was actually channeled through Elliott, and Dylan paid tribute to Elliott in Chronicles, 2004. From February 1961, Dylan played at various clubs around Greenwich Village. In September, he gained some public recognition when Robert Shelton wrote a positive review in the New York Times of a show at Gerd's Folk City. The same month, Dylan played harmonica on folk singer Carolyn Hester's eponymous third album, which brought his talents to the attention of the album producer John Hammond. Hammond signed Dylan to Columbia Records in October. The performances on his first Columbia album, Bob Dylan, 1962, consisted of familiar folk, blues, and gospel material combined with two original compositions. The album made little impact, selling only 5,000 copies in its first year, just enough to break even. Within Columbia Records, some referred to the singer as Hammond's folly and suggested dropping his contract. Hammond defended Dylan vigorously. While working for Columbia, Dylan also recorded several songs under the pseudonym Blind Boy Grunt for Broadside Magazine, a folk magazine and record label. Dylan used the pseudonym Bob Landy to record as a piano player on the 1964 anthology album The Blues Project, issued by Elektra Records. Under the pseudonym Ted M. Porterhouse, Dylan contributed a harmonica to Ramblin' Jack Elliott's 1964 album, Jack Elliott. Dylan made two important career moves in August 1962. He legally changed his name to Bob Dylan and signed a management contract with Albert Grossman. Grossman remained Dylan's manager until 1970, and was notable both for his sometimes confrontational personality and for the fiercely protective loyalty he displayed toward his principal talent. Dylan subsequently said of Grossman, "He was kind of like a Colonel Tom Parker figure. You could smell him coming." Tensions between Grossman and John Hammond led Hammond to being replaced as the producer of Dylan's second album by the young African-American jazz producer Tom Wilson. From December 1962 to January 1963, Dylan made his first trip to the United Kingdom. He had been invited to play TV director Philip Seville to appear in a drama, The Madhouse on Castle Street, which Seville was directing for BBC Television. At the end of the play, Dylan performed Blowin' in the Wind, one of the first major public performances of the song. While in London, Dylan performed at several London folk clubs, including Les Cousins, The Pinder of Wakefield, and Bungees. He also learned new songs from several UK performers, including Martin Carthy. By the time Dylan's second album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, was released in May 1963, He had begun to make his name as both a singer and a songwriter. Many of the songs on this album were labeled protest songs, inspired partly by Guthrie and influenced by Pete Seeger's passion for topical songs. Oxford Town, for example, was a sardonic account of James Meredith's ordeal as the first black student to risk enrollment at the University of Mississippi. His most famous song at this time, Blown in the Wind, partially derived its melody from the traditional slave song, No More Auction Block, while its lyrics questioned the social and political status quo. The song was widely recorded and became an international hit for Peter, Paul, and Mary, setting a precedent for many other artists who had hits with Dylan's songs. A Hard Rain's A-Gonna Fall was based on the folk ballad Lord Randall. With its veiled references to nuclear apocalypse, it gained even more resonance when a Cuban Missile Crisis developed only a few weeks after Dylan began performing it. Like Blown in the Wind, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall marked an important new direction in modern songwriting, blending a stream of consciousness, imagist, lyrical attack with a traditional folk form. While Dylan's topical songs solidified his early reputation, Freewheelin' also included a mixture of love songs and jokey, surreal, talking blues. Humor was a large part of Dylan's persona, and the range of material on the album impressed many listeners, including the Beatles. George Harrison said, "We just played it, just wore it out." The content of the song's lyrics and the attitude, it was incredibly original and wonderful. The rough edge of Dylan's singing was unsettling to some early listeners, but an attraction to others. Describing the impact that Dylan had had on her husband, Joyce Carol Oates wrote, "When we first heard this raw, very young, and seemingly untrained voice, frankly nasal, as if sandpaper could sing, the effect was dramatic and electrifying." Many of his most famous early songs first reached the public through more immediately palatable versions by other performers, such as Joan Baez, who became Dylan's advocate as well as his lover. Baez was influential in bringing Dylan to national and international prominence by recording several of his early songs and inviting him on stage during her own concerts. Others who had recorded and had hits with Dylan songs in the early and mid-1960s included The Byrds, Sonny and Cher, The Hollies, Peter, Paul and Mary, The Association, Manfred Mann, and The Turtles. Most attempted to impart a pop feel and rhythm to the songs, while Dylan and Baez performed them mostly as sparse folk pieces. The cover versions became so ubiquitous that CBS started to promote him with the tag, "Nobody sings Dylan like Dylan." Mixed Up Confusion, recorded during the Freewheelin' sessions with a backing band, was released as a single and then quickly withdrawn. In contrast to the mostly solo acoustic performances on the album, the single showed a willingness to experiment with a rockabilly sound. Cameron Crowe described it as a fascinating look at a folk artist with his mind wandering toward Elvis Presley and Sun Records. Protest and Another Side. In May 1963, Dylan's political profile was raised when he walked out of the Ed Sullivan Show. During rehearsals, Dylan had been informed by CBS Television's head of program practices that the song he was planning to perform, Talkin' John Birch Paranoid Blues, was potentially libelous to the John Birch Society. Rather than comply with the censorship, Dylan refused to appear on the program. By this time, Dylan and Baez were both prominent in the civil rights movement, singing together at the March on Washington on August 28, 1963. Dylan's third album, The Times They Are Changin', reflected a more polarized and cynical Dylan. The songs often took their subject matter, contemporary real-life stories, with Only a Pawn in Their Game addressing the murder of civil rights worker Medgar Evers, and the Brechtian The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, the death of black hotel barmaid Hattie Carroll at the hands of young white socialite William Zansinger. On a more general theme, Ballad of Hollis Brown and North Country Blues expressed the despair engendered by the breakdown of farming and mining communities. This political material was accompanied by two personal love songs, Boots of Spanish Leather and One Too Many Mornings. By the end of 1963, Dylan felt both manipulated and constrained by the folk and protest movements. These tensions were publicly displayed when, accepting the Tom Paine Award from the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee shortly after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, an intoxicated Dylan brashly questioned the role of the committee, characterized the members as old and balding, and claimed to see something of himself and of every man in Kennedy's alleged assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. Another side of Bob Dylan, recorded on a single, June Evening, in 1964, had a lighter mood than its predecessor. The surreal humorous Dylan emerged on I Shall Be Free No. 10 and Motor Psycho Nightmare. Spanish Harlem Incident and To Ramona are romantic and passionate love songs, while Black Crow Blues and I Don't Believe You, She Acts Like We Have Never Met, suggest the rock and roll soon to dominate Dylan's music. It Ain't Me, Babe, on the surface a song about spurned love, has been described as a rejection of the role his reputation had thrust at him. His newest direction was signaled by two lengthy songs, the impressionistic Chimes of Freedom, which sets elements of social commentary against a denser metaphorical language in a style later characterized by Allen Ginsberg of Chains of Flashing Images, and My Back Pages, which attacks the simplistic and arch-seriousness of his own earlier topical songs and seems to predict the backlash he was about to encounter from his former champions as he took a new direction. In the latter half of 1964 and 1965, Dylan's appearance and musical style changed rapidly as he made his move from leading contemporary songwriter of the folk scene to folk rock pop music star. His scruffy jeans and work shirts were replaced by a Carnaby Street wardrobe, sunglasses day or night, and pointy beetle boots. A London reporter wrote, "Hair that would set the teeth of a comb on edge, a loud shirt that would dim neon lights of Leicester Square. He looks like an undernourished cockatoo." Dylan also began to spar in increasingly surreal ways with his interviewers. Appearing on the Les Crane TV show and asked about a movie he was planning to make, he told Crane it would be a cowboy horror movie. Asked if he played the cowboy, Dylan replied, "No, I play my mother." Going Electric. Main article, Dylan Electric Controversy. Dylan's April 1965 album, Bringing It All Back Home, was yet another stylistic leap, featuring his first recording made with electric instruments. The first single, Subterranean Homesick Blued, owed much to Chuck Berry's Too Much Monkey Business, and was provided with an early music video courtesy of D.A. Pennebaker's Cinema Verite presentation of Dylan's 1965 tour of England, Don't Look Back. Its free association lyrics both harken back to the manic energy of beat poetry and were a forerunner of rap and hip-hop. By contrast, the B-side of the album consisted of four long songs on which Dylan accompanied himself on acoustic guitar and harmonica. Mr. Tambourine Man quickly became one of Dylan's best-known songs when the Byrds recorded an electric version that reached number one in both the US and the UK charts. It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding were acclaimed as two of Dylan's most important compositions. In the summer of 1965, as the headliner at the Newport Folk Festival, Dylan performed his first electric set since his high school days with a pickup group drawn mostly from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, featuring Mike Bloomsfield, guitar, Sam Lay, drums, and Jerome Arnold, bass, plus Al Cooper, organ, and Barry Goldberg, piano. Dylan had appeared at Newport in 1963 and 1964, but in 1965, Dylan met with a mix of cheering and booing, left the stage after only three songs. One version of the legend has it that the boos were from outraged folk fans whom Dylan had alienated by appearing, unexpectedly, with an electric guitar. Murray Lerner, who filmed the performance, said, "I absolutely think that they were booing Dylan going electric." An alternative account claims audience members were merely upset by the poor sound quality and a surprising short set. This account is supported by Cooper and one of his directors, of the festival, who reports his audio recording of the concert proves that the only booze in reaction to the MC's announcement there was only enough time for a short set. Nevertheless, Dylan's 1965 Newport performance provoked a hostile response from the folk music establishment. In the September issue of Sing Out, singer Ewan McCall wrote, "Our traditional songs and ballads are the creations of extraordinarily talented artists working inside disciplines formulated over time. But what of Bobby Dylan?" screamed the outraged teenagers. Only a completely non-critical audience, nourished on the watery pap of pop music, could have fallen for such tenth-rate drivel. On July 29th, just 4 days after his controversial performance at Newport, Dylan was back in the studio in New York, recording Positively 4th Street. The lyrics teemed with images of vengeance and paranoia, and it was widely interpreted as Dylan's put-down of former friends from the folk community, friends he had known in clubs along West 4th Street. Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde. In July 1965, Dylan released the single Like a Rolling Stone, which peaked at number 2 in the US and number 4 in the UK charts. At over 6 minutes, the song has been widely credited with altering attitudes about what a pop single could convey. Bruce Springsteen, in his speech during Dylan's inauguration to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, said that on first hearing the single, "That snare shot sounded like somebody had kicked open the door to your mind." In 2004, Rolling Stone magazine listed it as the number 1 on its list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. The song also opened Dylan's next album, Highway 61 Revisited, titled after the road that led from Dylan's Minnesota to the musical hotbed of New Orleans. The songs were in the same vein as the hit single, flavored by Mike Bloomfield's blues guitar and Al Kooper's organ riffs. Desolation Row offers the sole acoustic exception, with Dylan making surreal allusions to a variety of figures in Western culture. During his epic song, which was described by Andy Gill as an 11-minute epic of entropy, which takes the form of a Fellini-esque parade of grotesques and oddities featuring a huge cast of celebrated characters. Some historical, Einstein, Nero, some biblical, Noah, Cain, and Abel, some fictional, Ophelia, Romeo, and Cinderella, and some literary, T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, and some who fit into none of the above categories, notably Dr. Filth and his dubious nurse. In support of the record, Dylan was booked for 2 U.S. concerts and set about assembling a band. Mike Bloomfield was unwilling to leave the Butterfield Band, so Dylan mixed Al Kooper and Harvey Brooks from his studio crew with bar band stalwarts Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm, best known at the time for being part of Ronnie Hawkins' backing band The Hawks, later to become The Band. On August 28th at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium, the group was heckled by an audience still annoyed by Dylan's electric sound. The band's reception on September 3rd at the Hollywood Bowl was more favorable. While Dylan and the Hawks met increasingly receptive audiences on tour, their studio efforts floundered. Producer Bob Johnson persuaded Dylan to record in Nashville in February 1966 and surrounded him with a cadre of top-notch session men. At Dylan's insistence, Robertson and Cooper came down from New York City to play on the sessions. The Nashville Sessions produced the double album Blonde on Blonde, featuring what Dylan later called "what thin, wild mercury sound." Al Kooper described the album as taking two cultures and smashing them together with a huge explosion. The musical world of Nashville and the world of the quintessential New York hipster. On November 22nd, 1965, Dylan secretly married 25-year-old model Sarah Lowndes. Some of Dylan's friends, including Ramblin' Jack Elliott, claim that, in conversation immediately after the event, Dylan denied that he was married. Journalist Nora Ephron first made the news public in the New York Post in February 1966,
with the headline, "Hush, Bob Dylan is Wed." Dylan undertook a world tour of Australia and Europe in the spring of 1966. Each show was split into two parts. Dylan performed solo during the first half, accompanying himself on acoustic guitar and harmonica. In the second half, backed by the Hawks, he played high-voltage electric music. This contrast provoked many fans, who jeered and slow-hand clapped. The tour culminated in a famously raucous confrontation between Dylan and his audience at the Manchester Free Trade Hall in England. The recording of this concert was finally given an official release in 1998 on the album The Bootleg Series, Volume 4, Bob Dylan Live 1966. At the climax of the evening, a member of the audience, John Cordwell, who was angry with Dylan's electric sound, shouted, "Judas!" To which Dylan responded, "I don't believe you. You're a liar." Dylan turned to his band and said, "Play it fucking loud." And they launched into the final song of the night with gusto, like a rolling stone. Motorcycle accident and reclusion. After his European tour, Dylan returned to New York, but the pressures on him increased. ABC Television had paid in advance for a TV show they could screen. His publisher, Macmillan, was demanding a finished manuscript of the poem novel Tarantula. Manager Albert Grossman had already scheduled an extensive concert tour for that summer and fall. On July 29, 1966, Dylan crashed his 500cc Triumph Tiger 100 motorcycle on a road near his home in Woodstock, New York, throwing him to the ground. Though the extent of his injuries were never fully disclosed, Dylan said that he broke several vertebrae in his neck. Mystery still surrounds the circumstances of the accident, since no ambulance was called to the scene and Dylan was not hospitalized. Dylan's biographers have written that the crash offered Dylan a much-needed chance to escape from the pressures that built up around him. Dylan confirmed this interpretation of the crash when he stated in his autobiography, "I had been in a motorcycle accident and I'd been hurt, but I recovered. Truth was that I wanted to get out of the rat race." In the wake of the accident, Dylan withdrew from the public and, apart from a few select appearances, did not tour again for 8 years. Once Dylan was well enough to resume creative work, he began editing the film footage of his 1966 tour for Eat the Document, a rarely exhibited follow-up to Don't Look Back. A rough cut was shown to ABC Television and was promptly rejected as incomprehensible to a mainstream audience. In 1967, he began recording music with the Hawks at his home and in the basement of the Hawks' nearby house, called Big Pink. These songs, initially compiled as demos for other artists to record, provided hit singles for Julie Driscoll, This Wheel's on Fire, The Byrds, You Ain't Goin' Nowhere, Nothing Was Delivered, and Manfred Mann, Mighty Quinn. Columbia belatedly released singles from them in 1975 as The Basement Tapes. Over the years, more and more of the songs recorded by Dylan and his band in 1967 appeared on various bootleg recordings, culminating in a 5-CD bootleg set titled The Genuine Basement Tapes, containing 107 songs and alternate takes. In the coming months, the Hawks recorded the album Music from Big Pink, using songs they first worked on in their basement in Woodstock, and renamed themselves The Band, thus beginning a long and successful recording and performing career of their own. In October and November 1967, Dylan returned to Nashville. Back in the recording studio after a 19-month break, he was accompanied only by Charlie McCoy on bass, Kenny Buttrey on drums, and Pete Drake on steel guitar. The result was John Wesley Harding, a quiet, contemplative record of shorter songs set in a landscape that drew on both the American West and the Bible. Sparse structure and instrumentation, coupled with lyrics that took the Judeo-Christian tradition seriously, marked a departure not only from Dylan's own work, but from the escalating psychedelic fervor of 1960s music culture. It included All Along the Watchtower, with lyrics derived from the Book of Isaiah. The song was later recorded by Jimi Hendrix, whose version Dylan later acknowledged as definitive. Woody Guthrie died on October 3, 1967, and Dylan made his first live appearance in 20 months at a Guthrie Memorial Concert held at Carnegie Hall on January 20, 1968, where he was backed by the band. Dylan's next release, Nashville Skyline, was virtually a mainstream country record featuring instrumental backing by Nashville musicians. A mellow-voiced Dylan, a duet with Johnny Cash, and the hit single Lay Lady Lay, which he originally wrote for the Midnight Cowboy soundtrack, but did not submit in time to make the final cut. In May 1969, Dylan appeared on the first episode of Johnny Cash's new television show, duetting with Cash on Girl from the North Country, I Threw It All Away, and Living the Blues. Dylan next traveled to England to top the bill at the Isle of Wight Rock Festival on August 31, 1969, after rejecting overtures to appear at the Woodstock Festival, far closer to his home. 1970s. In the early 1970s, critics charged Dylan's output was of varied and unpredictable quality. Rolling Stone magazine writer and Dylan loyalist Grail Marcus notoriously asked, "What is this shit?" upon first listening to 1970s Self-Portrait. In general, Self-Portrait, a double LP including few original songs, was poorly received. Later that year, Dylan released New Morning, which some considered a return to form. In November 1968, Dylan had co-written I'd Have You Anytime with George Harrison. Harrison recorded both I'd Have You Anytime and Dylan's If Not For You for his 1970 solo triple album All Things Must Pass. Dylan's surprise appearance at Harrison's 1971 concert for Bangladesh attracted much media coverage, reflecting that Dylan's live appearances had become rare. Between March 16th and 19th, 1971, Dylan reserved 3 days at Blue Rock Studios, a small studio in New York's Greenwich Village. These sessions resulted in one single, Watching the River Flow, and a new recording of When I Paint My Masterpiece. On November 4, 1971, Dylan recorded George Jackson, which he released a week later. For many, the single was a surprising return to protest material, mourning the killing of Black Panther George Jackson in San Quentin Prison that summer. Dylan contributed piano and harmony vocals to Steve Goodman's album Somebody Else's Troubles under the pseudonym Robert Milkwood Thomas in September 1972. In 1972, Dylan signed on to Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, providing songs and backing music for the movie, and playing the role of Alias, a member of Billy's gang with some historical basis. Despite the film's failure at the box office, the song Knockin' on Heaven's Door has proven its durability as one of Dylan's most extensively recorded songs. Return to touring. Dylan began 1973 by singing with a new record label, David Geffen's Asylum Records, when his contract with Columbia Records expired. On his next album, Planet Waves, he used the band as backing group while rehearsing for a major tour. The album included two versions of Forever Young, which became one of his most popular songs. As one critic described it, the song provided something hymnal and heartfelt that spoke of the father in Dylan. Dylan himself commented, "I wrote it thinking about one of my boys and not wanting to be too sentimental." Biographer Howard Sounds noted that Jacob Dylan believed the song was about him. Columbia Records simultaneously released Dylan, a haphazard collection of studio outtakes, almost exclusively cover songs, which was widely interpreted as a churlish response to Dylan's signing with a rival record label. In January 1974, Dylan returned to live touring after a break of 7 years. Backed by the band, he embarked on a high-profile coast-to-coast North American tour, playing 40 concerts. A live double album of the tour, Before the Flood, was released on Asylum Records. Soon, Columbia Records sent word that they will spare nothing to bring Dylan back into the fold. Dylan had second thoughts about Asylum, apparently miffed that while there had been millions of unfulfilled ticket requests for the 1974 tour, Geffen had managed to sell only 700,000 copies of Planet Waves. Dylan returned to Columbia Records, which subsequently reissued two Asylum albums on their imprint. After the tour, Dylan and his wife became publicly estranged. He filled a small red notebook with songs about relationships and ruptures, and quickly recorded a new album entitled Blood on the Tracks in September 1974. Dylan delayed the album's release, however, and re-recorded half of the songs at Sound 80 Studios in Minneapolis, with production assistance from his brother, David Zimmerman. Released in early 1975, Blood on the Tracks received mixed reviews. In the NME, Nick Kent described the accompaniments as often so trashy they sound like mere practice takes. In Rolling Stone, reviewer John Landau wrote that the record has been made with typical shoddiness. However, over the years, critics have come to see it as one of Dylan's greatest achievements, perhaps the only serious rival to his mid-60s trilogy of albums. In Salon.com, Bill Wyman wrote, "Blood on the Tracks is his only flawless album and his best produced. The songs, each of them, are constructed in disciplined fashion. It is his kindest album and his most dismayed, and seems in hindsight to have achieved sublime balance between the logorrhea-plagued excesses of his mid-1960s output and the self-consciously simple compositions of his post-accident years." Novelist Rick Moody called it the truest, most honest account of a love affair from tip to stern ever put down on magnetic tape. That summer, Dylan wrote a lengthy ballad championing the cause of boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter, who had been imprisoned for triple murder committed in Paterson, New Jersey in 1966. After visiting Carter in jail, Dylan wrote Hurricane, presenting the case for Carter's innocence. Despite its 8:32-minute length, the song was released as a single, peaking at number 33 on the U.S. Billboard chart, and performed at every 1975 date of Dylan's next tour, Rolling Thunder Review. The tour was a varied evening of entertainment featuring about 100 performers and supporters drawn from the resurgent Greenwich Village folk scene, including T-Bone Burnett, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Joni Mitchell, David Mansfield, Roger McGuinn, Mick Johnson, Joan Baez, and violinist Scarlett Rivera, whom Dylan discovered while she was walking down the street, her violin case hanging on her back. Allen Ginsberg accompanied the troupe, staging scenes from the film Dylan was simultaneously shooting. Sam Shepard was initially hired to write the film's screenplay, but ended up accompanying the tour as an informal chronicler. Running through late 1975 and again through early 1976, the tour encompassed the release of the album Desire, with many of Dylan's songs featuring an almost travelogue-like narrative style, showing the influence of his new collaborator, playwright Jacques Levy. The spring 1976 half of the tour was documented by the TV concert special Hard Rain, and the LP, Hard Rain, no concert album from the better-received and better-known opening half of the tour, was released until 2002's Live 1975. The fall 1975 tour with The Review also provided the backdrop to Dylan's nearly four-hour film Rinaldo and Clara, a sprawling and improvised narrative mixed with concert footage and reminiscences. Released in 1978, the movie received generally poor, sometimes scathing reviews, and had a very brief theatrical run. Later in that year, Dylan allowed a two-hour edit, dominated by concert performances, to be more widely released. In November 1976, Dylan appeared at the band's farewell concert, along with other guests including Joni Mitchell, Muddy Waters, Van Morrison, and Neil Young. Martin Scorsese's acclaimed cinematic chronicle of this show, The Last Waltz, was released in 1978 and included about half of Dylan's set. In 1976, Dylan also wrote and duetted on the song Sign Language for Eric Clapton's No Reason to Cry. In 1978, Dylan embarked on a year-long world tour, performing 114 shows in Japan, the Far East, Europe, and the U.S. to a total audience of 2 million people. For the tour, Dylan assembled an 8-piece band, which was also accompanied by 3 backing singers. Concerts in Tokyo in February and March were recorded and released as the live double album Bob Dylan at Budokan. Reviews were mixed. Robert Christgau awarded the album a C-plus ranking, giving the album a derisory review, while Janet Maslin defended it in Rolling Stone, writing, "These latest live versions of his old songs have the effect of liberating Bob Dylan from the originals." When Dylan brought the tour to the U.S. in September 1978, he was dismayed the press described the look and sound of his show as a Las Vegas tour. The 1978 tour grossed more than $20 million, and Dylan acknowledged to the Los Angeles Times that he had some debts to pay off because I had a couple bad years. I put a lot of money into a movie, built a big house, and it costs a lot to get divorced in California. In April and May 1978, Dylan went into the studio in Santa Monica, California, to record an album of new material with the same large band and backing vocalists, Street Legal. It was described by Michael Gray as After Blood on the Tracks, arguably Dylan's best record of the 1970s, a crucial album documenting a crucial period in Dylan's own life. However, it suffered from poor sound recording and mixing attributed to Dylan's studio practices, muddying the instrumental detail until a remastered release in 1999 restored some of the song's strengths.
In the late 1970s, Dylan became a born-again Christian and released 2 albums of Christian gospel music. Slow Train Coming, 1979, featured the guitar accompaniment of Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits and was produced by veteran R&B producer Jerry Wexler. Wexler recalled that when Dylan had tried to evangelize him during the recording, he replied, "Bob, you're dealing with a 62-year-old Jewish atheist. Let's just make an album." The album won Dylan a Grammy Award as Best Male Vocalist for the song Gotta Serve Somebody. The second evangelical album, Saved, received mixed reviews and was described by Dylan critic Michael Gray as the nearest thing to a follow-up album Dylan has ever made. Slow Train Coming to and Inferior. When touring from the fall of 1979 through the spring of 1980, Dylan would not play any of his older secular works, and he delivered declarations of his faith from the stage, such as, "Years ago, they said I was a prophet. I used to say, 'No, I'm not a prophet.' They say, 'Yes, you're a prophet.' I said, 'No, it's not me.' They used to say, 'You sure are a prophet.' They used to convince me I was a prophet. Now I come out and say Jesus Christ is the answer. They say, 'Bob Dylan's no prophet.' They just can't handle it." Dylan's embrace of Christianity was unpopular with some of his fans and fellow musicians. Shortly before his murder, John Lennon recorded Serve Yourself in response to Dylan's Gotta Serve Somebody. By 1981, while Dylan's Christian face was obvious, Stephen Holden wrote in the New York Times that neither age, he's now 40, nor his much-publicized conversion to born-again Christianity has altered his essentially iconoclastic temperament. In the fall of 1980, Dylan briefly resumed touring for a series of concerts billed as a musical retrospective, where he restored several of his popular 1960s songs to the repertoire. Shot of Love, recorded next spring, featured Dylan's first secular compositions in more than 2 years, mixed with explicitly Christian songs. The haunting Every Grain of Sand reminded some critics of William Blake's verses. In the 1980s, the quality of Dylan's recording work varied, from the well-regarded Infidels in 1983 to the panned Down in the Groove in 1988. Such critics as Michael Gray condemned Dylan's 1980s albums both for showing an extraordinary carelessness in the audio and for failing to release his best songs.
The Infidels recording sessions, for example, produced several notable songs that Dylan left off the album. Most regarded of these were Blind Willie McTell, a tribute to the dead blues musician, and an evocation of African American history, Foot of Pride, and Lord Protect My Child. These three songs were later released on the Bootleg Series, Volumes 1 to 3, Rare and Unreleased, 1961 to 1981. Between July 1984 and March 1985, Dylan recorded his next studio album, Empire Burlesque. Arthur Baker, who had remixed hits for Bruce Springsteen and Cyndi Lauper, was asked to engineer and mix the album. Baker has said he felt he was hired to make Dylan's album sound a bit more contemporary. Dylan sang on USA for Africa's famine relief fundraising single, We Are the World. On July 13, 1985, he appeared at the climax of the Live Aid concert at JFK Stadium, Philadelphia. Backed by Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood, Dylan performed a ragged version of Hollis Brown, his ballad of rural poverty, and then said to the worldwide audience exceeding 1 billion people, I hope that some of the money, maybe they can just take a little bit of it, maybe, 1 or 2 million maybe, and use it to pay the mortgages on some of the farms and the farmers here out to the banks. His remarks were widely criticized as being inappropriate, but they did inspire Willie Nelson to organize a series of events, Farm Aid, to benefit debt-ridden American farmers. In April 1986, Dylan made a brief foray into the world of rap music when he added vocals to the opening verse of Street Rock, a song featured on Curtis Blow's album Kingdom Blow. Dylan's next studio album, Knocked Out Loaded, was released in July 1986 and contained three cover songs by Little Junior Parker, Kris Kristofferson, and the traditional gospel hymn Precious Memories, plus three collaborations with other writers, Tom Petty, Sam Shepard, and Carol Bayer Sager, and two solo compositions by Dylan. One reviewer commented that the record follows too many detours to be consistently compelling, and some of those detours wind down roads that are indisputably dead ends. By 1986, such uneven records weren't entirely unexpected by Dylan, but that didn't make them any less frustrating. It was the first Dylan album since Freewheelin', 1963, to fail to make the top 50. Since then, some critics have called the 11-minute epic that Dylan co-wrote with Sam Shepard, Brownsville Girl, a work of genius. In 1986 and 1987, Dylan toured extensively with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, sharing vocals with Petty on several songs each night. Dylan also toured with the Grateful Dead in 1987, resulting in a live album, Dylan and the Dead. This album received some very negative reviews. AllMusic said, quite possibly the worst album by either Bob Dylan or the Grateful Dead. After performing with these musical permutations, Dylan initiated what came to be called the Never-Ending Tour on June 7, 1988, performing with a tight backup band featuring guitarist G.E. Smith. Dylan continued the tour with this small but constantly evolving band for the next 20 years. In 1987, Dylan starred in Richard Marquand's movie Hearts of Fire, in which he played Billy Parker, a washed-up rock star turned chicken farmer, whose teenage lover Fiona leaves him for a jaded English synth-pop sensation, played by Rupert Everett. Dylan also contributed two original songs to the soundtrack, Night After Night and I Had a Dream About You, Baby, as well as a cover of John Hyatt's The Usual. The film was a critical and commercial flop. Dylan was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in January 1988, with Bruce Springsteen's introductory speech declaring, Bob, free your mind the way Elvis freed your body. He showed us just because music was innately physical did not mean that it was anti-intellectual. When Dylan released the album Down in the Groove in May 1988, it was even more unsuccessful in its sales than his previous solo album. Michael Gray wrote, The very title undercuts any idea that inspired work may lie within. It was a further devaluing of the notion of a new Bob Dylan album as something significant. The critical and commercial disappointment of that album was swiftly followed by the success of the Traveling Wilburys. Dylan co-founded the band with George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, Roy Orbison, and Tom Petty. In the fall of 1988, their multi-platinum Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 reached number 3 on the U.S. album chart, featuring songs that were described as Dylan's most accessible compositions in years. Despite Orbison's death in December 1988, the remaining four recorded a second album in May 1990, which they released with the unexpected title Traveling Wilburys Volume 3. Dylan finished the decade on a critical high note with Oh Mercy, produced by Daniel Lanois. Dylan critic Michael Gray wrote that the album was attentively written, vocally distinctive, musically warm, and uncompromisingly professional. This cohesive whole is the nearest thing to a great Bob Dylan album in the 1980s. The track Most of the Time, a lost love composition, was later predominantly featured in the film High Fidelity, while What Was It You Wanted has been interpreted both as a catechism and a wry comment on the expectations of critics and fans. The religious imagery of Ring Them Bells struck some critics as a reaffirmation of faith. 1990s. Dylan's 1990s began with Under the Red Sky, an about-safe from the serious Oh Mercy. The album contained several apparently simple songs, including Under the Red Sky and Wiggle Wiggle. The album was dedicated to Gabby Goo Goo. This was later explained as a nickname for the daughter of Dylan and Carolyn Dennis, Desiree Gabrielle Dennis Dylan, who was 4 at the time. Sidemen on the album included George Harrison, Slash from Guns N' Roses, David Crosby, Bruce Hornsby, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and Elton John. Despite the stellar lineup, the record received bad reviews and sold poorly. In 1991, Dylan was honored by the recording industry with a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award from American actor Jack Nicholson. The event coincided with the start of the Gulf War against Saddam Hussein, and Dylan performed his song Masters of War. Dylan then made a short speech that startled some of the audience. The next few years saw Dylan returning to his roots with two albums covering old folk and blues numbers, Good As I Been to You, 1992, and World Gone Wrong, 1993, featuring interpretations and acoustic guitar work. Many critics and fans commented on the quiet beauty of the song Love Pilgrim, penned by a 19th century teacher and sung by Dylan with a haunting reverence. In November 1994, Dylan recorded two live shows for MTV Unplugged. He claimed his wish to perform a set of traditional songs for the show was overruled by Sony executives who insisted on a greatest hits package. The album produced from it, MTV Unplugged, included John Brown, an unreleased 1963 song, detailing the ravages of both war and jingoism. With a collection of songs reportedly written while snowed in on his Minnesota ranch, Dylan booked recording time with Daniel Lanois at Miami's Criteria Studios in January 1997. The subsequent recording sessions were, by some accounts, fraught with musical tension. Late that spring, before the album's release, Dylan was hospitalized with a life-threatening heart infection, pericarditis, brought on by histoplasmosis. His scheduled European tour was canceled, but Dylan made a speedy recovery and left the hospital, saying, "I really thought I'd be seeing Elvis soon." He was back on the road by midsummer and in early fall performed before Pope John Paul II at the World Eucharistic Conference in Bologna, Italy. The Pope treated the audience of 200,000 people to a homily based on Dylan's lyric, Blown in the Wind. September saw the release of the new Lanois-produced album, Time Out of Mind. With its bitter assessment of love and morbid ruminations, Dylan's first collection of original songs in 7 years was highly acclaimed. One critic wrote, "The songs themselves are uniformly powerful, adding up to Dylan's best overall collection in years." His collection of complex songs won him his first solo Album of the Year Grammy Award. In December 1997, U.S. President Bill Clinton presented Dylan with a Kennedy Center honor in the East Room of the White House, paying this tribute. "He probably had more impact on people of my generation than any other creative artist. His voice and lyrics haven't always been easy on the ear, but throughout his career, Bob Dylan has never aimed to please. He has disturbed the peace and discomforted the powerful."
Dylan commenced the new millennium by winning his first Oscar. His song, "Things Have Changed," penned for the film Wonder Boys, won an Academy Award in March 2001. The Oscar, by some reports a facsimile, tours with him, presiding over shows perched atop an amplifier. "Love and Theft" was released on September 11th, 2001. Recorded with his touring band, Dylan produced the album himself under the pseudonym Jack Frost. The album was critically well-received and earned nominations for several Grammy Awards. Critics noted that Dylan was widening his musical palette to include rockabilly, western swing, jazz, and even lounge ballads. In 2003, Dylan revisited the evangelical songs from his born-again period and participated in the CD project Gotta Serve Somebody, the gospel songs of Bob Dylan. That year also saw the release of the film Masked and Anonymous, which Dylan co-wrote with director Larry Charles under the alias Sergei Petrov. Dylan played the central character in the film, Jack Fate, alongside a cast which included Jeff Bridges, Penelope Cruz, and John Goodman. The film polarized critics. Many dismissed it as an incoherent mess, and a few treated it as a serious work of art. In October 2004, Dylan published the first part of his autobiography, Chronicles Volume 1. The book confounded expectations. Dylan devoted three chapters to his first year in New York City in 1961-62, virtually ignoring the mid-60s when his fame was at its height. He also devoted chapters to the albums New Morning and Oh Mercy. The book reached number 2 on the New York Times hardcover nonfiction bestseller list in December 2004, and was nominated for a National Book Award. Martin Scorsese's acclaimed film biography No Direction Home was broadcast in September 2005. It was shown on September 26th to 27th, 2005 on BBC Two in the UK and PBS in the US. The documentary focuses on the period from Dylan's arrival in New York in 1961 to his motorcycle crash in 1966, featuring interviews with Suze Rotolo, Liam Clancy, Joan Baez, Allen Ginsberg, Pete Seeger, Mavis Staples, and Dylan himself. The film received a Peabody Award in April 2006 and a Columbia DuPont Award in January 2007. The accompanying soundtrack featured unreleased songs from Dylan's early career. Modern Times, 2006 to 2008. May 3rd, 2006 was the premiere of Dylan's DJ career, hosting a weekly radio program, Theme Time Radio Hour, for XM Satellite Radio, with song selections revolving around a chosen theme. Dylan played classic and obscure records from the 1930s to the present day, including contemporary artists as diverse as Blur, Prince, LL Cool J, and The Streets. The show was praised by fans and critics as great radio, as Dylan told stories and made eclectic references with his sardonic humor, while achieving a thematic beauty with his musical choices. In April 2009, Dylan broadcast the 100th show in his radio series. The theme was Goodbye, and the final record play was Woody Guthrie's So Long, It's Been Good to Know Ya. This has led to speculation that Dylan's radio series may have ended. On August 29th, 2006, Dylan released his Modern Times album. Despite some coarsening of Dylan's voice, a critic for The Guardian characterized his singing on the album as a guttural death rattle. Most reviewers praised the album, and many described it as the final installment of a successful trilogy, embracing Time Out of Mind and Love and Theft. Modern Times entered the U.S. charts at number one, making it Dylan's first album to reach that position since 1976's Desire. Nominated for 3 Grammy Awards, Modern Times won Best Contemporary Folk Americana Album, and Bob Dylan also won Best Solo Rock Vocal Performance for Someday Baby. Modern Times was named Album of the Year 2006 by Rolling Stone magazine, and Uncut in the UK. On the same day that Modern Times was released, the iTunes Music Store released Bob Dylan The Collection, a digital box set containing all of his albums, 773 tracks in total, along with 42 rare and unreleased tracks. In August 2007, the award-winning film biography of Dylan, I'm Not There, written and directed by Todd Haynes, was released, bearing the tagline, inspired by the music and many lives of Bob Dylan. The movie uses 6 distinct characters to represent different aspects of Dylan's life, played by Christian Bale, Kate Blanchett, Marcus, Carl Franklin, Richard Gere, Heath Ledger, and Ben Whishaw. Dylan's previously unreleased 1967 recording, from which the film takes its name, was released for the first time on the film's original soundtrack. All other tracks are covers of Dylan songs, specially recorded for the movie by a diverse range of artists, including Eddie Vedder, Mason Jennings, Stephen Malkmus, Jeff Tweedy, Karen O, Willie Nelson, Cat Power, Richie Havens, and Tom Verlaine. On October 1st, 2007, Columbia Records released the triple CD retrospective album Dylan, anthologizing his entire career under the Dylan 07 logo. As part of this campaign, Mark Ronson produced a remix of Dylan's 1966 tune, Most Likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine, which was released as a maxi single. This was the first time Dylan had sanctioned a remix of one of his classic recordings. The sophistication of the Dylan 07 marketing campaign was a reminder that Dylan's commercial profile had risen considerably since the 1990s. This first became evidenced in 2004 when Dylan appeared in a TV advertisement for Victoria's Secret Lingerie. 3 years later, in October 2007, he participated in a multimedia campaign for the 2008 Cadillac Escalade. Then, in 2009, he gave the highest profile endorsement of his career, appearing with rapper William in a Pepsi ad that debuted during the telecast of Super Bowl 43. The ad broadcast to a record audience of 98 million viewers opened with Dylan singing the first verse of Forever Young, followed by Will I Am, playing a hip-hop version of the song's third and final verse. In October 2008, Columbia released Volume 8 of Dylan's bootleg series, Telltale Signs, Rare and Unreleased, 1989 to 2006, as both a 2-CD set and a 3-CD version with a 150-page hardcover book. The set contains live performances and outtakes from selected studio albums, from Oh Mercy to Modern Times, as well as soundtrack contributions and collaborations with David Bromberg and Ralph Stanley. The pricing of the album, the 2-CD set went on sale for $18.99 and the 3-CD version for $129.99, led to complaints about rip-off packaging from some fans and commentators. The release was widely acclaimed by critics. The plethora of alternative takes and unreleased material suggested to Uncut's reviewer, Telltale Signs is awash with evidence of Dylan's staggering muscularity. His evident determination, even in the studio, to repeat himself as little as possible. Together Through Life, Christmas in the Heart, 2009. Bob Dylan released his album Together Through Life on April 28, 2009. In a conversation with music journalist Bill Flanagan, published on Dylan's website, Dylan explained that the genesis of the record was when a French film director, Oliver Dan, asked him to supply a song for his new movie, Road Movie, My Own Love Song. Initially only intending to record a single track, Life is Hard, the record sort of took its own direction. 9 out of the 10 songs on the album are credited as co-written by Bob Dylan and Robert Hunter. The album received largely favorable reviews, although several critics described it as a minor addition to Dylan's canon of work. Andy Gill wrote in The Independent that the record features Dylan in a fairly relaxed, spontaneous mood, content to grab such grooves and sentiments as flit momentarily across his radar. So, while it may not contain too many landmark tracks, it's one of the most naturally enjoyable albums you'll hear all year. In its first week of release, the album reached number one in the Billboard 200 chart in the US, making Bob Dylan, 67 years of age, the oldest artist to ever debut at number one on that chart. It also reached number one on the UK album chart, 39 years after Dylan's previous UK album chart topper, New Morning. This meant that Dylan currently holds the records for the longest gap between solo number one albums in the UK chart. On October 13, 2009, Dylan released a Christmas album, Christmas in the Heart, comprising such Christmas standards as Little Drummer Boy, Winter Wonderland, and Here Comes Santa Claus. Dylan's royalties from the sale of this album will benefit the charities Feeding America in the USA, Crisis in the UK, and the World Food Programme. The album received generally favorable reviews. The New Yorker commented that Dylan had welded a pre-rock musical sound to some of his croakiest vocals in a while, and speculated that Dylan's intentions might be iconic. Dylan has a long and highly publicized history with Christianity. To claim there's not a wink in the childish optimism of Here Comes Santa Claus or Winter Wonderland is to ignore a half century of biting satire. In USA Today, Edna Gunnarsson pointed out that Dylan was revisiting Yuletide styles popularized by Nat King Cole, Mel Torme, and the Ray Corniff Singers. Gunnarsson concluded that Dylan couldn't sound more sentimental or sincere. In an interview published by Street News Service, journalist Bill Flanagan asked Dylan why he had performed the songs in a straightforward style, and Dylan responded, "There wasn't any other way to play it. These songs are part of my life, just like folk songs. You have to play them straight too." The Bootleg Series, Volume 9, and the original mono recordings, the 2010s. On October 18, 2010, Dylan released Volume 9 of his bootleg series, the Witmark Demos. This comprised 47 demo recordings of songs taped between 1962 and 1964 for Dylan's earliest musical publishers, Leeds Music in 1962 and Witmark Music from 1962 to 1964. One reviewer described the set as a kind of alternative history of Dylan's songwriting process, writing 5 new songs before breakfast, as he once famously quipped. The critical aggregator website Metacritic awarded the album a Metascore of 86, indicating universal acclaim. In the same week, Sonny Legacy released Bob Dylan, the original mono recordings, a box set which for the first time presented Dylan's 8 earliest albums from Bob Dylan, 1962, to John Wesley Harding, 1967, in their original mono mix in the CD format, accompanied by new liner notes by Dylan critic Grail Marcus. Brandeis University, 1963. In February 2011, Legacy Recordings announced the release of Bob Dylan in Concert, Brandeis University, 1963, on April 11, 2011. The recording was taped at Brandeis University on May 10, 1963, 2 weeks prior to the release of the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. The tape had been discovered in the archive of music writer Ralph J. Gleason and had previously been available as a limited edition supplement to the Bootleg Series Volume 9. The recording will carry liner notes by Dylan scholar Michael Gray. Gray writes, "The Dylan performance it captured from way back when Kennedy was president and the Beatles hadn't yet reached America wasn't even on fans' radar. It reveals him not at any big moment, but giving a performance like his folk club sets of the period. This is the last live performance we have of Dylan before he becomes a star. Never-ending tour. The never-ending tour commenced on June 7, 1988, and Dylan has played roughly 100 dates a year for the entirety of the 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century, a heavier schedule than most performers who started out in the 1960s. By the end of 2010, Dylan and his band had played more than 2,300 shows, anchored by longtime bassist John Garnier, multi-instrumentalist Donnie Herron, and guitarist Charlie Sexton. To the dismay of some of the audience, Dylan's performances remain unpredictable as he altered his arrangements and changes his vocal approach night after night. Critical opinion about Dylan's shows remains divided. Critics such as Richard Williams and Andy Gill argue that Dylan has found a successful way to present his rich legacy of material. Others have criticized his vocal style as a one-dimensional growl with which he chews up, mangles, and spits out the greatest lyrics ever written so that they are effectively unrecognizable, and his lack of interest in bonding with his audience. In January 2011, Dylan's organization published details of performances scheduled to take place in Taiwan, China, Vietnam, and Australia in April 2011. Artist. Over a decade after Random House had published Drawn Blank, 1994, a book of Dylan's drawings, an exhibit of his art, the Drawn Blank series, opened in October 2007 at the Kunstsammlungen in Chemnitz, Germany. This first public exhibition of Dylan's paintings showcased more than 200 watercolors and gouaches made earlier in 2007 from the original drawings. The exhibition's opening also premiered the release of the book Bob Dylan, The Drawn Blank Series, which includes 170 reproductions from the series. From September 2010 until April 2011, the National Gallery of Denmark is exhibiting 40 large-scale acrylic paintings by Dylan, the Brazil series. Personal life. Family. Dylan married Sarah Lowndes on September 22, 1965. Their first child, Jesse Byron Dylan, was born on January 6, 1966, and they had three more children, Anna Lee, Samuel Isaac Abraham, and Jacob Luke, born December 9, 1969. Dylan also adopted Sarah's daughter from a prior marriage, Maria Lowndes, later Dylan, born October 21, 1961. She is now married to musician Peter Himmelman, an Orthodox Jew. In the 1990s, his son Jacob became well known as the singer of the band The Wallflowers. Jesse Dylan is a film director and a successful businessman. Bob and Sarah Dylan were divorced on June 29, 1977. In June 1986, Dylan married his longtime backup singer Carolyn Dennis, often professionally known as Carol Dennis. Their daughter, Desiree Gabrielle Dennis Dylan, was born on January 31, 1986. The couple divorced in 1992. Their marriage and child remained a closely guarded secret until the publication of Howard Sound's Dylan biography, Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan in 2001. Dylan now lives in Malibu, California, when not on the road. Religious beliefs. Growing up in Hibbing, Minnesota, Dylan and his parents were part of the area's small but close-knit Jewish community, and in May 1954, Dylan had his bar mitzvah. Around the time of his 30th birthday, in 1971, Dylan visited Israel and also met Rabbi Meir Kane, founder of the New York-based Jewish Defense League. Time magazine quoted Dylan saying about Kane, "He's a really sincere guy. He's really put it all together." Later, Dylan downplayed the extent of his contact with Kane. For a period during the late 1970s and early 1980s, Bob Dylan publicly converted to Christianity. From January to April 1979, Dylan participated in a Bible study classes at the Vineyard School of Discipleship in Reseda, California. Pastor Ken Gulliskin has recalled, "Larry Myers and Paul Emmond went over to Dylan's house and ministered to him. He responded by saying, yes, he did in fact want Christ in his life, and he prayed that day and received the Lord. By 1984, Dylan was deliberately distancing himself from the Born Again label. He told Kurt Loder of Rolling Stone magazine, "I've never said I'm born again. That's just a media term. I don't think I've been an agnostic. I've always thought there's a superior power, and this is not the real world, and there's a world to come." In response to Loder's asking whether he belonged to any church or synagogue, Dylan laughingly replied, "Not really. The Church of the Poison Mind." In 1987, he told David Gates of Newsweek, "Here's the thing with me and the religious thing. This is the flat-out truth. I find the religiosity and philosophy in the music. I don't find it anywhere else. Songs like 'Let Me Rest on a Peaceful Mountain' or 'I Saw the Light,' that's my religion. I don't adhere to rabbis, preachers, evangelists, all of that. I've learned more from the songs than I've learned from any of this kind of entity. The songs are my lexicon. I believe the songs." In an interview published in the New York Times on September 28, 1997, journalist John Perelles reported that Dylan says he now subscribes to no organized religion. Dylan has been described in the last 20 years as a supporter of the Chabad Lubavitch movement and has privately participated in Jewish religious events, including the bar mitzvahs of his sons and attending Hadar HaTorah, a Chabad Lubavitch yeshiva. Subsequently, Jewish news services have reported that Dylan has shown up a few times at various high holy days for services at various Chabad synagogues. For example, he attended Congregation Beth Tefillah in Atlanta, Georgia on September 22, 2007, Yom Kippur, where he was called to the Torah for the sixth Aliyah. Dylan has continued to perform songs from his gospel albums in concert, occasionally covering traditional religious songs. He has also made passing references to his religious faith, such as in a 2004 interview with 60 Minutes, when he told Ed Bradley that the only person you have to thank twice about lying to is either yourself or to God. He also explained his constant touring schedule as part of a bargain he made a long time ago with the chief commander. "In this earth and in the world we can't see." In a 2009 interview with Bill Flanagan, promoting his Christmas LP, Christmas in the Heart, Flanagan commented on the heroic performance Dylan gave of O Little Town of Bethlehem, and that Dylan delivered the song like a true believer. Dylan replied, "Well, I am a true believer." Legacy. Bob Dylan is one of the most influential figures of the 20th century, musically and culturally. Dylan was included in the Time 100, the most important people of the century, where he was called master poet, caustic social critic, and intrepid guiding spirit of the counterculture generation. Biography Howard Sounds placed him among the most exalted company when he said, "There are giant figures in art who are sublimely good. Mozart, Picasso, Frank Lloyd Wright, Shakespeare, Dickens. Dylan ranks alongside these artists." Initially modeling his style on the songs of Woody Guthrie and lesson learned from the blues of Robert Johnson, Dylan added increasingly sophisticated lyrical techniques to the folk music of the early 1960s, infusing it with the intellectualism of classical literature and poetry. Paul Simon suggested that Dylan's early compositions virtually took over the folk genre. Dylan's early songs were very rich, with strong melodies. "Blown in the Wind" has a really strong melody. He so enlarged himself through the folk background that he incorporated it for a while. He defined the genre for a while. When Dylan made his move from acoustic music to a rock backing, the mix became more complex. For many critics, Dylan's greatest achievement was the cultural synthesis exemplified by his mid-1960s trilogy of albums, Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde. In Mike Marcuse's words, between the late 1964 and the summer of 1966, Dylan created a body of work that remains unique, drawing on folk, blues, country, R&B, rock and roll, gospel, British beat, symbolist, modernist, and beat poetry, surrealism, and Dada, advertising jargon and social commentary, Fellini and Mad Magazine, he forged a coherent and original artistic voice and vision. The beauty of these albums retains the power to shock and console. One legacy of Dylan's verbal sophistication was the increasing attention paid by literary critics to his lyrics. Professor Christopher Ricks published a 500-page analysis of Dylan's work, placing him in the context of Eliot, Keats, and Tennyson, and claiming that Dylan was a poet worthy of the same close and painstaking analysis. Former British poet laureate Andrew Motion argued that Bob Dylan's lyrics should be studied in schools. Since 1996, academics have lobbied the Swedish Academy to award Dylan the Nobel Prize in Literature. Dylan's voice was, in some ways, as startling as his lyrics. New York Times critic Robert Shelton described Dylan's early vocal style as a rusty voice suggesting Guthrie's old performances, etched in gravel like Dave Van Ronk's. David Bowie, in his tribute, Song for Bob Dylan, described Dylan's singing as a voice of sand and glue. Dylan's voice continued to develop as he began to work with rock and roll backing bands. Critic Michael Gray described the sound of Dylan's vocal on his hit single, Like a Rolling Stone, as at once young and jeeringly cynical. As Dylan's voice aged during the 1980s, for some critics it became more expressive. Christoph Lebold writes in the journal Oral Tradition, Dylan's more recent broken voice enables him to present a world view at the sonic surface of the songs. This voice carries us across the landscape of a broken, fallen world. The anatomy of a broken world in Everything is Broken on the album Oh Mercy is but an example of how the thematic concern with all things broken is grounded in a concrete sonic reality. Dylan's influence has been felt in several musical genres. As Edna Gunderson stated in USA Today, Dylan's musical DNA has informed nearly every simple twist of pop since 1962. Many musicians have testified to Dylan's influence, such as Joe Strummer, who praised Dylan as having laid down the template for lyric, tune, seriousness, spirituality, depth of rock music. Other major musicians to have acknowledged Dylan's importance include John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Pete Townshend, Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie, Ryan Ferry, Nick Cave, Patti Smith, Syd Barrett, Cat Stevens, and Tom Waits. More directly, The Byrds and The Band, two 1960s contemporary groups with some measure of influence on pop music themselves, largely owed their initial success to Dylan. The Byrds with their hit of Mr. Tambourine Man, and subsequent album, The Band for their association with him on tour in 1966, on Retreat in Woodstock, and on their debut album featuring three previously unreleased Dylan songs. There have been dissenters. Because Dylan was widely credited with imbuing pop culture with a new seriousness, the critic Nick Kahn objected, "I can't take the vision of Dylan as seer, as teenage messiah, as everything else he's been worshipped as. The way I see him, he's a minor talent with a major gift for self-hype. Similarly, Australian critic Jack Marks credited Dylan with changing the persona of the rock star. What cannot be disputed is that Dylan invented the arrogant, faux-cerebral posturing that has been the dominant style in rock since, with everyone from Mick Jagger to Eminem educating themselves from the Dylan handbook. In 2010, Joni Mitchell described Dylan as a plagiarist and a fake in an interview in the Los Angeles Times. Mitchell's comments led to discussions of Dylan's use of other people's material, both supporting and criticizing Dylan. If Dylan's legacy in the 1960s was seen as bringing intellectual ambition to popular music, as Dylan approaches the age of 70, he is today described as a figure who has greatly expanded the folk culture from which he emerged. As Jay Hoberman wrote in The Village Voice, Elvis might never have been born, but someone else surely would have brought the world rock and roll. No such logic accounts for Bob Dylan. No iron law of history demanded that a would-be Elvis from Hibbing, Minnesota, would swerve through the Greenwich Village
Greenwich Village Folk Festival revival to become the world's first and greatest rock and roll beatnik bard, and then, having achieved fame and adoration beyond reckoning, vanish into a folk tradition. This extract was retrieved March 15, 2011, and read April 15, 2011. The text is available under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 Unported License. I'm Daniel Welsh. That's Daniel space Welsch.